Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Janet Yellen at the Fed, debt limit deniers in Congress, and James Fallows on small town economies. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, 9 days into the great government shutdown of 2013. The 9th of October is the date. Yes, another day of you having to listen to me say it doesn't look like we're much closer to solving this thing now, does it? And maybe the president was just trying to change the subject, or maybe he had some free time on his hands, what with the shutdown. But he picked today to name Janet Yellen to succeed Ben Bernanke as the head of the Federal Reserve. She was known not to be the president's first pick. Larry Summers withdrew last month, you'll recall. And she may not have been Wall Street's either. She's never been one to cozy up to the finance community. So how do you suppose Wall Street is feeling about our new economist-in-chief? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore took a not-so-random walk down Wall Street to find out.
Janet Yellen is the first woman to be nominated to run the Fed in its 100-year history, but this is the Fed we're talking about. And even on Wall Street, she didn't get a ton of name recognition.
I have to say, I haven't researched it enough, so I don't want to...
I don't have any information on it.
I don't even know about it.
No, I have no idea.
But for those who knew of her, like attorney Rick Figaro, they tipped their hat.
I think she's a good nomination. You know, it's good to have a woman to motivate other young female so they can reach great height.
At the end of the day, though, Wall Street is about the money.
I'm sure she'll fulfill her role, be she a man or a woman, with great ability. I don't think sex matters in these things, frankly.
That's Joe Hughes, an insurance underwriter. He, like many people on Wall Street, sees Yellen as the face of consistency.
I wouldn't imagine that the overall tenor of the Fed's approach to the economy will change very much at all, actually. I think she'll be a steady hand on the tiller.
Most people I spoke to don't see any daylight between Yellen and her predecessor, Ben Bernanke. Here's Bradley Selig and Joey Leon.
I mean, she's certainly qualified. You know, I actually don't think they're going to change policies much. What Bernanke's done, we're sort of, we're in it.
Kind of the same quantitative easing or QE unlimited that Bernanke has, and you kind of get that. I mean, it's good for the markets, so it's kind of like feeding into it.
Now, of course, consistency isn't a good thing if you don't agree with what the Fed's been doing, printing money to buy securities to prop up the economy.
She's really a continuation of what we have now, which is a doomed policy.
Long term, if you throw so much money into the economy, your dollars and cents won't be worth anything.
That was Pete Johnson and asset manager Ken Hallberg. But however you look at it, as recruiter Joe Sullivan put it, at least some part of the government is functioning right now.
That's the one part of government that we're right on. That's the one part. That ain't busted.
For now, confirmation hearings haven't started. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All those shutdown clocks and debt limit clocks aside, and yes, CNN, I am looking at you here, the shutdown is honestly... So yesterday, there is now a growing chorus of politicians in Washington who don't believe default. That is, letting the debt limit come and go on the 17th of October would be all that bad. Debt limit truthers, they're being called. And in fact, President Obama talked about them yesterday during his press conference.
So when I read people saying, this wouldn't be a big deal, we should test it out. Let's take default out for a spin and see how it rides.
We asked Marketplace's David Gura to do just that.
Steve King is a skeptic. He's a Republican congressman from Iowa who said this to CNN.
I think that all this talk about a default has been a lot of demagoguery, a lot of false demagoguery. We have plenty of money coming in to service the debt. When we stop servicing the debt, that would be default. We're a long, long ways from that.
Now that puts King at odds with politicians on both sides of the aisle, not to mention the White House and scores of academic and private economists. Say the financial markets would take a hit and interest rates would go up.
You don't know what's going to happen if you drive off a cliff, but you can presume it's not going to be good.
Michael Feroli is J.P. Morgan's chief U.S. economist.
We think it could throw the nation into a financial crisis and lead to a recession.
And even if the U.S. is still paying the interest on its debt, economists say borrowing costs would go through the roof, banks would stop lending, and Social Security checks would be delayed. In short, it would be a very rough ride. Stuart Hoffman is the PNC Financial Services Group's chief economist.
All the wheels are going to fall off. The engine's going to probably conk out, and who knows, maybe the car's going to catch on fire.
Hoffman points out the United States hasn't been down this road before.
But we've seen other countries that have defaulted on their debt.
Think Brazil and Argentina, Venezuela. Defaults hurt their standard of living, and they made it harder for those countries to borrow money. Jim Kessler is with the think tank Third Way, and he says those defaults only give us some sense of what could happen.
Our treasury bill and our dollar is the measuring stick for every financial transaction in the world.
And overnight, that could change.
And you could see some very bad worldwide reactions, possibly a worldwide recession.
Kessler says taking default for a spin would be like driving a lemon, and he wonders why anyone would choose to do that. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, two up, one down. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Once upon a time, back in the early, early days of the digital revolution, there was a dream that you could work anywhere. Laptops and cell phones would let you not have to commute. But then reality hit. First, Marissa Meyer at Yahoo, and now this week, bosses at Hewlett-Packard say workers should show up at the office more often. Nancy Kane from the Harvard Business School came to the office to discuss this with us. Hey, Nancy, it's good to have you back.
Pleasure to be here, Kai.
Marissa Meyer was clobbered for telling everybody at Yahoo they couldn't work at home, and now Hewlett-Packard does that, and what? Have we reached a tipping point here?
You know, I think we've reached an important inflection point, and here's what I think the nub of that is.
Okay.
It is that working together in person, what the economists who measure things like innovation and productivity in these kind of industries mm-hmm. call proximity, turns out to be great for innovation.
You know, I totally get that. And empirically, it makes sense. But in Hewlett-Packard's case specifically, and in much of the world writ large, flexibility is a huge issue, right? I mean, you want to be able to accommodate people's needs. And, you know, if I can just dial into a meeting, why shouldn't I just do it in my jammies from my living room? And I know that's not the way all people work at home, but...
You know, I think there's a really strong case to be made for that flexibility, but that doesn't necessarily translate into across-the-board stamp of approval on telecommuting at every moment, in every industry, for every company.
All right. Here's another way to think about this, and this will not be popular, and it will get me some emails. A job is a job. You show up, you do your job, boom.
So that, I think that's dead right. I think telecommuting gives workers, right, some real sense of empowerment and mm-hmm. control, and that's very important.
I'm looking at a stock chart as we sit here in the studio, and I'm obliged to note that Yahoo stock in the past year, plus or minus since Marissa Meyer made this announcement that everybody has to work in the office, is up 66%. Hewlett-Packard in the past year is absolutely flat, zero straight line flat yeah. over the past 12 months.
So again, it's hard if you're a very, very careful economist to say there's a really strict,
right.
you know,
right.
demonstrable correlation there.
However but, comma.
Right. However,
yeah.
right, the bottom line is that, you know, there seemed to be some really interesting stuff coming out of yeah. Yahoo in the yeah. last 6 months.
Right.
You know, we draw our conclusions, but you know, David Foster Wallace once said, technology and wealth have given us the power to be alone in our tiny skull-sized kingdoms at the center, with ourselves at the center of creation. Not all work is meant to be done alone, right? A lot of work, the best work right. often, is right. done with others in serious pursuit and often in a place where everyone meets to do it.
Nancy Kane teaches at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai.
The The harvest is upon us. Farmers have started bringing in their crops, and it's been a profitable couple of years for a lot of them. Take Iowa, land of corn, and then more corn. The price of farmland is up 80% the past 3 years, and now the Hawkeye State is home to some of the most expensive farmland in the world. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith went to the northwest corner of that state, the epicenter of the farmland price boom.
I have to climb a ladder to interview farmer Harwin Tislav. He's harvesting corn on his farm in Sioux County, Iowa.
Now, there's not a lot of room. You just sit right beside me there and we'll pull that door shut.
All right. Incidentally, he kind of looks like Clint Eastwood. What is this machine called?
This is a forage harvester, or a chopper.
Tislav carefully steers the chopper through long rows of corn. Monstrous triangular blades pull the green corn stalks up by the roots and shred them into cattle feed.
It looks like we're going to have an excellent crop of corn here this year.
Tislav has been farming here his whole life, and he can't believe how expensive things have gotten.
There's no way you could justify probably not even half the value of the land right now.
This is the most expensive farmland in the country, $22,000 an acre. Not that it's stopped Tislav from trying to buy more land.
Generally, it's already gone before anyone has an idea that something could be available.
So it's hyper-competitive.
Yeah, beyond that. On three different farms that I've bid against on the last year and a half, two made the New York Times.
Land deals around here are making national news and attracting investors from Silicon Valley and Wall Street. Tislav has had visitors from as far away as Egypt come to check out this famous dirt. Why is the Iowa farmland worth so much?
We're the best land in the world.
Mike Duffy is an economist at Iowa State University.
It's worth so much because of what it can do.
Namely, grow just about anything. Most years, there's plenty of rain. Centuries of prairie grasses have created black topsoil that runs hundreds of feet deep and can support demanding crops like corn. And corn prices have been on a tear. First, the 2007 Energy Act created a demand for corn-based ethanol. Then, a growing middle class in Asia created a demand for more corn-fed meat.
Growing up, we always thought of farmers as poor people, and they were. I mean, there was difficult times back then.
Native Iowan Jason Smith.
Today, there's a lot of new houses in the countryside. If you drive around the countryside, you'll see a lot of new combines, you'll see a lot of new tractors.
Which is very good news for Smith. His company, Dream Dirt, auctions off farmland and farm equipment.
All right, on the American grain tier, 500.
At the fairgrounds in the tiny town of Lenox, Iowa, combines, horse trailers, tractors are lined up on the grassy expanse. Smith and his crew drive from item to item in an RV, yelling prices out of a bullhorn. A group of around 100 farmers follows along. Prices for farm equipment have skyrocketed. A new combine, complete with touchscreen technology, can cost $500,000.
People joke about their sports cars, and then a farmer drives by in a combine, and his combine's worth five or six times more than that fancy sports car was.
But the run-up could be winding down. The price of corn is at a three-year low. The economies of China and India are flagging, and big corn-growing competition has cropped up in places like Africa. Economist Mike Duffy says Iowa farmland is at a turning point.
As corn prices settle back down, we're going to see land values fall off. It's going to be more of a deflating, though, than a bubble bursting.
Iowa farmland is expected to lose as much as 20% of its value in the next few years. Dream Dirt's Jason Smith has already noticed less demand from outside investors. But demand from local farmers is still strong. Smith expects to sell $100 million worth of land in the next year. After all, there is only so much of this rich farmland for sale. In Lenox, Iowa, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
If you ever have any farmland you're interested in selling, we love it all. We just love dirt. So.
Coming up, why it's good to be a small town in America today.
In a lot of these cities, they're finding ways to work within the constrained, hobbled, fractious, impossible-to-agree national setting.
What do you really think, Jim? The latest from American Futures coming up. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 26 points today, about a 10%, closed at 14,802. NASDAQ went the other way, though, ended down 17 points, nearly a half percent, 3677. The S&P 500 inched up, but just a point, a 10%, 1657 there. Men's Warehouse sewed up a 27% gain today on news that rival Joseph A. Bank made a $2.3 billion bid for the suit retailer. Joe's A. Bank, as it's officially known, buttoned up 7% today. Hewlett-Packard printed a 9% gain after it issued a positive progress report. Alcoa dug up nearly 2% today after it reported strong quarterly earnings. On the downside, Ariad Pharmaceuticals plunged 66% on news the FDA has placed a hold on trials of its cancer drug. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.66%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, Senate hearings on the debt limit and the economic impact of a default are scheduled. Nobel season continues with the announcement of the prize in literature. And British playwright Harold Pinter was born on October 10, 1930. He was a Nobel laureate in literature. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know who's really worried about the United States not figuring out a way to pay its bills? Some of the people overseas to whom we owe all that money, that's whom. Our two top foreign creditors, China and Japan, have both made public comments lately, warning Washington to be mindful as a possible default approaches. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has that story from Shanghai.
This week, China's vice finance minister made a carefully worded request to U.S. lawmakers to please ensure the safety of China's investments. In comments to the Chinese press last year, Zhu Guangyao was less cautious, bluntly spelling out the ramifications for China.
If America's fiscal cliff problem isn't managed well, it would probably reduce China's GDP by 1.2%.
This precise estimate is a sign that Beijing is watching the U.S. crisis very carefully, quite possibly with a calculator to assess potential damages. As it stands, China has nearly $1.3 trillion of U.S. Treasury bills. Japan's close behind at $1.1 trillion.
I don't think the Obama administration would be very worried that Beijing would, in fact, sell those bills and use the money to buy other things.
Willie Lam, professor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, says Beijing has little choice. After the crash in 2008, China began investing more in euros. When the EU's economy then hit the skids, China warily moved back to U.S. dollars. For all its faults, the U.S. economy remains the best investment for the world's other top economies. But Lam says the first U.S. default on debt in 225 years would probably force Beijing to make some tough decisions about where to put its money.
What Beijing could do is to, I think, gradually downsize its holdings of U.S. Treasury bills. But this would be a long, drawn-out process.
That's because nearly a third of China's foreign exchange holdings are parked in U.S. dollars, and a big sell-off would hurt China's economy at a time when the country's already dealing with its own slowdown. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The philanthropic urge is being felt more strongly as the government shutdown endures. A Houston-based billionaire named John Arnold and his wife Laura have given Head Start $10 million. That's to keep programs in six states up and running. A different group has pitched in to keep death benefits for military families coming while Congress figures out what it wants to do. Generous as they are, though, is government funding by charitable donation really what the founders had in mind? Marketplace's Noel King has that story.
Researchers at Indiana University's Lilly Family School of Philanthropy have been making a list of all the publicly reported charitable donations from U.S. residents, corporations, and private foundations of $1 million or more. There have been about 70,000 in the past 13 years. Research director Una Osili has noticed some trends.
During the recession and the post-recession period,
we have seen an increasing number of large gifts being made to either local or state, and in some cases federal entities.
But the Arnold's donation to Head Start stands out. Osley says usually people give to a school foundation or a museum rather than a specific government program. Katharina Roschetta of UPenn's Center for High Impact Philanthropy said this is an emergency donation.
Like an emergency for a major disaster, what we're seeing from the Arnolds is that they are coming in to address what can be a real emergency for the lifetime prospects of the kids in these programs.
You could argue it's an emergency that the government created. So is this kind of donation letting dysfunctional elected officials off the hook? Sally Amann is a spokeswoman for Head Start.
This is a stopgap measure that we are hopeful will keep a handful of programs open through the end of the month. There's 12 months in the year. There's no way private dollars can sustain the delivery of these services.
Amann said as thankful as Head Start is to the Arnolds, if the shutdown continues, this emergency starts all over again on November 1st. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
We've got a project going with Jim Fallows of The Atlantic and his wife Deb, in which they fly around the country in their own small plane, seeing what they can see, with us tagging along from time to time, trying to figure out what the American economy looks like right now. We call it American Futures.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo, we got Tango for landing.
Today, a pause to reflect on the government shutdown, the possibility of a default, the national economy, and what is going on in those small cities and towns that Jim and Deb and I have been visiting. Jim, it's good to have you back.
Kai, thanks so much. Nice to talk to you.
We get you between travels today, Mr. Fallows, and I want to ask you sort of a contextual question about, you know, given the state of the economy and the way things are going in Washington and all of that. What have you seen that gives you some insights into the towns that are making it out there and the towns that maybe are struggling a little bit?
We're used to hearing kind of the non-sophisticated contrast between the corrupt big city America and the vibrant small town real America. And I think there's a different impression which has struck us, which is that if you were entirely cut off from the national economic news of showdown, paralysis, and things falling apart, you could feel things were actually quite healthy in a lot of America. If you saw a number of the cities we've been going to and the kinds of businesses that are being created there, the markets they're serving around the world, the ambitions people are realizing.
You know, that idea of taking the smaller towns and smaller cities economy and shielding them from what's going on in Washington, who do you suppose would be worse off? Would the national economy be worse off if small cities and towns were taken out, or would the small cities and towns be worse off?
Right? Well, of course, I guess it's like asking, would you be worse off without your foot or your hand?
Because you
need to have them both. But at the moment, I would argue that you see the real health of America. In a lot of these cities, they're finding ways to work within the constrained, hobbled, fractious, impossible-to-agree national setting and saying, okay, we can agree here locally. We can find ways to serve markets around the world. We can find ways to build up our university and attract talent from around the world, too.
It's interesting that some of these places are not intentionally, but just in a matter of course, having to bypass the national level discussion and go international. You know, as you mentioned, there's some of the places we found in Sioux Falls.
It's true. And here's another thing I'm trying to find the right way to convey the texture of, that some of the most interesting cities we've been to now, five or six of them we spent some time in, they are simultaneously very local in their consciousness and culture, and very global in their outlook, by which I mean some little place in Minnesota or in Michigan or in Vermont that is serving customers literally in Mongolia and in the Congo and in Azerbaijan or wherever else. And yet those same people are thinking, how can we find ways to improve the civic culture of this particular little place? And I think that this may be surprising to me because I'm from Washington, D.C. now, where there's no local pride at all.
It can't all be, though, Jim, that small towns are not all of them can be thriving. Not all of them can be doing well, right? I mean, there are some that just haven't figured it out yet.
Oh, that certainly is the case. And as you and I have discussed before, the success of a place like Sioux Falls in South Dakota has been predicated upon the sort of draining out of a lot of the surrounding prairie areas, a lot of the Dakotas as people have come there. And so we are not purporting to say we have a completely accurate rendering of all the goods and bads of America right now. But we're looking for, at least as a first step, of saying, if there are places that are working, what can you deduce from them, and what can that be applied elsewhere?
James Fallows of The Atlantic, he and his wife, Deborah, are on an episodic cross-country trip in their own private little plane. I'm tagging along every now and then. It's a project we're calling American Futures. I'll see you, in a couple of weeks out in Eastport, Maine, right, Jim?
Weather permitting, as always.
As always. All right, we'll see you then.
Thanks, Guy.
You can follow along in the continuing adventures of Jim and Deb Fallows and our project American Futures at our website, marketplace.org. Jim's awesome blog is there as well. And if there's a place you think we ought to go, tell us.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which I will set up by saying ticker symbol DIS, the Walt Disney Company, lost about 0.5% today. Not a big deal, but then there is this. Disney has decided it's going to stop issuing actual paper stock certificates, as have many other companies, to be sure. Yes, I know. But come on, how many of those had Bambi and Mickey and Donald Duck on them, right? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. Today, the Dow up 26 points, about 0.1%. The NASDAQ ended the day down 17 points, nearly 0.5%. The S&P 500 inched up just a point. That is about 0.1%. I wish I had a good Donald Duck voice here. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carmen, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.